You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, with World Refugee Day approaching and with new figures counting more people displaced by crisis than at any point since 1945, we look at the issue from front lines in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean. I'll be joined by Samira Shackle and Shashank Joshi to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
It's true, I am not optimistic because of their actions on the ground, their destruction and killing of innocents, and especially their actions in Aden and Taiz and the rest of Yemen's cities. Their actions and words here since they arrived in Geneva do not demonstrate any good intentions on their part.
Peace talks that need peace talks. That was Yemen's foreign minister there discussing his Houthi antagonists as the warring parties get around a table in Geneva and the table gets upended. We'll also ask how hard it can possibly be to get rid of 16 tons of unwanted plutonium, and we'll look at the latest example of Russian diplomacy by conspiracy theory. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, journalist and commentator, and Shashank Joshi, senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both back to the program. Now, this coming Saturday, June 20th, is World Refugee Day. That same date last year saw the global figure of refugees, which includes those displaced within their own countries, at more than 50 million for the first time since the end of World War II. According to a UNHCR report released today, that number has spiked still further since to nearly 60 million. And the determination of those people to leave places plagued by war or poverty has been answered by the desperation of the more prosperous world to figure out what it owes them and what to do with them. We should talk at all, first of all, I guess, about that word refugees and the difference between that and the word migrants, which is often applied to the, especially in Europe in recent months, to the boat-borne exodus across the Mediterranean. Samira, I'll ask you first, is that distinction important? Because when politicians and media use the word migrants rather than refugees, are they basically signalling that we don't actually owe them anything?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening with that. And I think we've seen it over the course of certainly the last decade, probably longer, but very acutely in the last decade in the UK, this conflation of refugees, asylum seekers with economic migrants, as they're called, and so on, and this idea that the one is masquerading as the other, and that you have people who are seeking to move country for purely economic reasons, are claiming asylum or whatever, and as which is an international right. And I think that while that may happen, I think it's certainly overplayed the extent to which it happens, and it's quite a politically useful. I think it's sort of politically useful to make that elision and sort of conflate the one with the other, because it's quite, I mean, it's something that I think that that sort of obligation to asylum seekers is something that lots of governments would rather avoid.
We'll be discussing shortly a few specific instances of places where this issue has been brought into a particular focus. But Shashank, is there or could there be a general point at which what you might call the first world is morally or legally entitled to decide, look, this really isn't our problem?
Well, in some ways, the obligation's pushed in the other direction. It's the idea that, you know, some of the poorest and most vulnerable states are bearing some of the most refugees at the moment. I'm thinking here of, you know, Lebanon. I'm thinking of people going into Iraq from Syria, if you can believe that.
Pakistan and Iran have for decades hosted enormous Afghan refugee populations.
Absolutely. And of course, we all seen Thailand.
People going from Yemen to Somalia, I think, was the most extreme example of that.
Absolutely. So in some ways, the question isn't at what point do we reach the threshold where we say it's not our issue. It's at what point do we decide Lebanon, Thailand, you know, Somalia, these countries really can't take the burden. We're the ones who may be better placed to do so, which then brings us into a much more complex discussion about who within the developed world, including particularly within Europe, splits the burden.
We'll get to that one shortly. But Samira, that is a perfectly reasonable point Shashank makes there, that the burden of these already poor and desperate people tends to fall disproportionately on already poor and desperate countries, which seem to me at least to make actually less fuss about it than the rich ones do. I mean, is this a kind of countrywide illustration of that general fact that, especially when you travel, you notice this, that it tends to be people in poorer countries who are far more generous with their time than those in richer countries?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps to an extent, there's certainly hostility within lots of those countries, I think, to refugees. I mean, for instance, in Pakistan, there's been sort of quite a lot of state and civilian hostility to the massive Afghan refugee population. Even now, after decades, some of them, there's sort of talk about deportations and so on. So I think that is quite universal. I think there's two things probably. One, I mean, perhaps there is in certain places more of a cultural attitude to being welcoming or whatever. But I think putting that aside, that lots of places simply do have much weaker states in these poor and desperate countries that we're talking about, and they don't have the kind of state apparatus to have those strong borders. I think there's also, I think one of the things that European governments in the citing a lot at the moment in terms of the refugee crisis in the Middle East is this idea of keeping people within the region, and it's better because they've got a common language and so on, which I think some of that is excuse making, certainly, but there's just the sort of logistical thing as well of where do you send them back to? If you're the Lebanese government and you're sort of bordering these countries where people are just flowing in, what do you do?
Okay, yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about a few specific examples where this has come into focus in the last few weeks. Italy this week, obviously Italy, the first port of call for a great many Mediterranean migrants, has this week forcibly removed about 100 African immigrants who have been denied entry to France and since stranded in the Italian city of Ventimiglia. France has already returned 6,000 migrants to Italy. You may argue that that's somewhat hypocritical of France, which for many years famously housed refugees about as close to the Channel Tunnel entrance as they possibly could, with everything but signs saying Britain this way. But Shashank, that illustrates the point you were making earlier, that European leaders on the one hand are sort of semi-happy to talk in general terms about, you know, what we should do and how we should help, etc., etc. But no one, realistically, nobody actually wants these people, do they?
Well, I think we should say that some of the Scandinavian countries have been generous in accepting them.
And that is true. Sweden in particular has stepped up.
But of course, the burden is imbalanced. Germany takes a lot. The Scandinavians take a lot. The UK says, look, we're not part of Schengen, so that's one of the reasons we don't need to take a lot. And of course, this is coming at the worst possible time in terms of our national political debate, in terms of the attitudes towards immigration and asylum. And so I don't... You know, it's true that no one really wants them, but there is an existing imbalance, and some of the bigger countries are unwilling to address that. And I think, you know, Italy's frustration is reasonable here. Their southern camps are exploding. They're redistributing some of these around the country to cope, but they have their own domestic problems. And they're saying, look, if you don't do something about this, we'll start giving these people Schengen permits, temporary Schengen permits, and then let's see how you like it when they're legally allowed to wander into France at will.
Well, Italy also has problems within Italy in that it's trying to spare the southern regions from dealing with all of it and to get Italian regions to take quotas of refugees, and they won't. The governor of Veneto, Luca Zaia, has ordered migrant housing removed from tourist areas around Venice because he's worried about putting off tourists and protecting the local economy. Is the problem, though, Samira, that this is what strikes me as the biggest problem that Europe has in trying to deal with this, that there's little sympathy, I think, among either Europeans' populations or Europeans' media, and for any European politician to try and take a lead on this, especially from a point of view of a compassionate perspective. They're putting their own job at risk, aren't they?
I think it, as Shashank rightly said, I think this has come at a really bad time, not just in terms of the British national political debate, but across Europe. You've got sort of rising anti-immigration sentiment, sort of rise in far-right parties in lots of different countries and so on. So I think there's no doubt that it's politically difficult, but I do think that when you have something that's essentially an international humanitarian crisis, that there is a certain extent to which elected politicians have a responsibility to just do the thing that's right, and actually not just the thing that's right here, but the thing that's practical. Because, you know, you have the EU asking member states to take a certain quota of countries in the way that Germany or Scandinavia has. It's not actually huge numbers that they're asking different member states to take. The UK has point blank said they're not going to. France and Spain are also very resistant, as are many other countries. And I think that that's not only sort of an avoidance of responsibility to some of the poorest and most vulnerable people in the world, I think it's also just profoundly stupid, because people are going to keep coming, people are going to find ways to cross borders and so on, people are desperate. So I don't really see that there's a clear argument for not at least keeping those people within the system where you can keep track of them, give them some kind of temporary status, give them the ability to work legally and pay taxes and so on. And so while I do take the point that, you know, it's politically difficult, it's politically fraught, it's politically sensitive, I think that there needs to be some better leadership on it.
Hungary, Shashank, is talking of building a 4-metre-high fence along its border with Serbia, which has become a major European crossing point for refugees from Afghanistan, Syria and Iraq. Hungary, which obviously has a certain amount of experience of far-right populist politics, but it would doubtless argue that it is merely protecting its borders and protecting its national interests as any country is entitled to. Are they wrong?
Well, Hungary is an interesting example. I think while some of their national rhetoric around immigrants is deplorable, they, of all of these cases, perhaps the most justified in saying the people coming through are clear economic migrants rather than asylum seekers. They're coming from Kosovo. Kosovo is no longer war-torn in the way it was, you know, 15 years ago. These are not people who've lost their homes in Syria. These are people, you know, who have probably a little more choice, although probably still very, very poor conditions from in Kosovo itself. And I think you can see why Hungary would take some of these steps. But particularly as Hungary is on the edge of the EU in that sense, it doesn't get very much help from Europe at a national level. And they probably feel a little bit abandoned as well.
I mean, Samira, the same question, I guess, but set in a different location. One of those poorer countries we mentioned earlier on whom this burden disproportionately falls has long been the Dominican Republic, which, while not being a rich country, is at least richer than its perennially luckless neighbour, Haiti. They're going to renew a programme of deporting Haitian immigrants if they haven't registered under a new regularisation programme. So far, 210,000 of them have. I mean, again, at what point is it permissible for a country to say that, which is what Dominica is saying, that Haiti's problems, while terrible, are not the problems of the Dominican Republic?
I think that there's a distinction to be drawn between sort of what you're talking about and the point at which countries say this is now too much, and the sort of going slightly over and above that, which is what the Dominican Republic seems to be doing. They passed a law in 2013 stripping citizenship from children who are born in the Dominican Republic to foreign parents. And those kind of moves are quite extreme, as I think are mass deportations, which again made me think of the sort of recent drive by the Pakistani state to stage mass deportations of Afghan refugees, many of whom, like Haitians in the Dominican Republic, had been there for many years. And I think when you have that kind of mass scale deportation, which is not just about people who are recent migrants, but is also encompassing people who've lived there problem-free for many years, some of whom were even born there, I think that's quite a different thing. And that starts to be less about a sort of legitimate concern about a sort of strain on the state and more about sort of getting rid of the other.
I think it's also, in response to your question, is there a point at which you can say there's no more responsibility? You know, consider Jordan, where some of the biggest cities in Jordan are now refugee camps and have been for over a year, where, you know,
to say nothing of the decades of inflows of Palestinian refugees before that.
Of course, systematically changing their political system and the balance at the very top. So if a country like that hasn't got to the point where it's saying enough is enough and is closing a border off to allow people to be shot by Al-Qaeda or ISIS or anyone else or Assad, you think, well, we in Europe certainly are in a more comfortable position.
A subject to which we will doubtless return in future episodes of Midori House, but we will look now at Yemen, which is itself an increasing source of refugees fleeing what now looks barely distinguishable from full-scale civil war. Peace talks have been taking place in Geneva, the effectiveness of which may be gauged from the fact that the highlight of said negotiations was a punch-up which began when someone threw a shoe at the leader of the Houthi delegation. I always like the way that media reports say that this is an insult in the Arab world. I mean, it just makes me wonder, yeah, where isn't it? I mean, there's nowhere I can think of where it's regarded as just like shaking hands.
Do you not
hands.
Greet your visitors by throwing shoes at them? I do it all the time.
My people do not generally
okay.
sort of...
Greet, right.
if, Just for future reference, if an Australian does throw a shoe at you, be insulted.
Oh, okay, good. Yes, yeah, thank you. I'm going to write that one down.
Yeah. I mean, Shashank, it does seem to me as a basic precursor for a successful peace negotiations that parties to them must actually be interested in peace. Have we reached that point in Yemen yet?
I thought you were going to say the precursor was they must throw shoes at
or
each
must,
other.
Or must not throw shoes
no,
at each
not,
other.
No, we're not at that point, I think. What we're seeing is Houthis fairly confident that a Saudi military campaign isn't fulfilling its objectives. They haven't been dislodged from any of the cities they've taken. They're firmly in control of Sana'a. And I think they realize world attention is also looking a little bit critically at Saudi Arabia, saying they've just killed a convoy of 31 people who were fleeing a city. European and American publics may say, well, hang on, should we be giving assistance to Saudi Arabia in this campaign? Now, whether that judgment is right or wrong, I think the Houthis are in no mood to give up just yet. And on the other hand, the Saudis, I think, also see this is a really important time. There may be a nuclear deal with Iran coming soon. They view the Houthis as Iranian proxies. This is not the time to go wobbly from the Saudi perspective. So I think this is going to play out for really some months before we see this wind down.
But on that subject, Samira, the Saudis have now been bombing Yemen since March, or bombing the Houthis in Yemen since March, at least when their bombs land on the right people. As far as it's possible to tell, which is difficult with Yemen because almost nobody is reporting independently from inside Yemen for fairly obvious reasons, has it made any effective difference to anything?
It doesn't seem to. I mean, it hasn't been a particularly successful campaign. And I think, as Shashank says, that's why the peace process at the moment is a bit of a non-starter. It's something that anyone's even bothered to turn up, I think. They clearly don't really want to talk about anything. And I think from the Saudi perspective, it risks becoming a bit of an embarrassment. I mean, it's part of the much more muscular foreign policy that they've adopted. But, you know, it's a very, very complicated thing to wade into. I mean, it's from the Saudi perspective, yes, the Houthis are Iranian proxies. They don't want that on their doorstep. But actually, this is not just a simple sectarian war. This is sort of a whole plethora of geographical, sectarian and tribal rivalries that go back generations. And so it's a very, very messy and complicated and multifaceted and multi-fronted war. And I think it's in that sort of environment very difficult to, I mean, it's very difficult anyway to have, as we saw to our great cost in Libya, very difficult to sort of barge in, have airstrikes, get out with the victors. But I think particularly when you've got such a complicated sort of many-angled conflict, it's really, really hard for a foreign power to just sort of quickly sweep in and get what they want to get.
I would say two things when we're looking at judging Saudi Arabia here. First of all, the UN's on their side, fundamentally. UN resolutions do say the Houthis have to get out of these cities they've taken. And the UN mediator at this conference, the peace conference, is getting a bit frustrated with the Houthis, who are saying, well, they've, you know, they can't decide who should be in their negotiating team. It's a little annoyed about that. Second of all, while I think you're right, there is a danger of turning into an embarrassment, from the Saudi perspective, they have accomplished a few important things, and we should bear that in mind. One of which, for example, is destroying Scud missiles the Houthis have. Now, you don't want the Houthis, who are not nice people, to have long-range missiles that they can launch into Saudi Arabia if you're sitting in Riyadh. And so they have achieved some of their war aims, I'd say.
Just a final thought, though, on this, Shashank, about a potential exciting new dimension to this conflict. In the last day or two, Islamic State has claimed a couple of bombings in Sana'a. Is that a plausible claim, or are they doing that thing which I suspect they've done more than once before, of just putting their hand up when something's blown up somewhere?
You know, I think it is a plausible claim. I think they've got this core caliphate in Iraq and Syria, but the next ring, the second ring of their strategy, is in places like Yemen or the Sinai Peninsula or Libya, where they can't quite seize large amounts of territory, but they're quite good at organizing bombings and making a presence for themselves amid that chaotic Al-Qaeda, Houthi, Yemeni, Saudi, you know, a multifaceted front, as Samira said. I think this is their way of planting their flag, particularly at a very important time when the leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen has just been killed, probably been killed a day or so ago. And I think that should really, really worry us.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, the second-hand plutonium market, and Russia takes tinfoil hat diplomacy to the next level.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, The Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, The Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
And you are welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Shashank Joshi. Now, more than 4 years since the tsunami-prompted calamity at the Fukushima reactor, Japan still hasn't quite figured out what it now thinks of nuclear energy. Among those wishing they would make their minds up is France, currently the somewhat reluctant host of 16 tons of Japanese plutonium. This cache is at, or cache rather, is at Areva's reprocessing plant in Normandy. Areva is the French energy giant which has a contract with Japanese utilities to take the plutonium. I'm, like you, Samira, I rather suspect, something of a newcomer to the laws, traditions and customs and manners surrounding large piles of unwanted plutonium. Is this the Japanese government's problem?
Well, I think it probably is. If they've sort of purchased the stuff and ended their program, and you've got sort of huge amounts of this material just sort of sitting around, I think it's quite like it's their problem, not just practically, but I think also diplomatically. You've got worries in the region, in China and elsewhere, that Japan could be doing in Iran and in the eyes of the world, you know, sort of using this vast stock of plutonium to sort of transform it into weapons grade and so on. And so I think it's certainly a problem that Japan needs to sort out. I mean, it's quite as you were saying, a newcomer to this, but it's quite a strange idea, just a huge volumes of this stuff.
There's 20 tons of it at Sellafield here in the UK, Japanese plutonium, which Britain has apparently offered to take ownership of.
At a price. We're not going to do it for free.
That's an inversion of the usual rules of supply and demand. It's like, we will pay you to keep this thing.
Because it's really annoying to have lots of plutonium. You know, a really small amount, compared to uranium, highly enriched uranium, a really small amount of plutonium is enough to make a bomb with, and it's suitable for dirty bombs, whereas highly enriched uranium is not that suitable for dirty bombs, contrary to what people think. So really, it's Japan's problem if it's just sitting here, and the sheer quantities are mind-boggling. You know, if Japan was an Iran-type country, and it thankfully is not, and has never really in modern times dabbled in that in recent periods, this could do some serious damage. You could put an industrial-scale bomb program with all of this.
Is it that dangerous, though? Because this is something that gets floated every so often, sort of James Bond stroke Bourne Identity idea of terrorists acquiring a quantity of fissile material. Is plutonium in this quantity, is it something we should be worried about?
There's two problems. One is terrorists getting it, and yes, we should be worried about that, because although security is good, as I said, you only need a tiny amount to cause havoc. And number two, if Japan keeps large amounts of this, you have countries like South Korea, who, by the way, as we all know, are not on the best terms with Japan, let alone countries like China, saying, well, we're not really that comfortable with Japan accumulating vast quantities of bomb-making material. I think someone should deal with this. And right now, if North Korea increases its arsenal, China modernizes, people will look at this and think, no, Japan has to, you know, show its good faith here, I think.
Okay, well, finally tonight, denying, or to borrow the euphemism, raising questions about the moon landings is widely and correctly recognised as the exclusive province of friendless cranks typing furiously into online fora through a haze of Pringles crumbs, generally in their mother's basements. Vladimir Markin, however, head of Russia's investigative committee, has nevertheless enlisted himself in this troglodyte legion, suggesting that aspects of the Apollo story might benefit from his organization's scrutiny. Samira, in fairness to Mr. Markin, it's not actual outright denial here as such. There's just a certain amount of nudging and winking going on about the fact that famously NASA contrived to erase or lose the original footage, which is still amazing.
Yeah.
But one of those things which I don't think surprises anybody with any experience of a large government bureaucracy. It's just the sort of thing that happens. Where do you think he's actually going with this?
It's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, you kind of wonder. It's slightly after the event to call for an investigation at this point. And it's just, it's amusing on lots of different levels. I think partly the sort of official endorsement of conspiracy theory. Then there's also the sort of sad shadows of the Cold War space race. And it's just, I think it should be seen really in the context, apart from the fact that it's ridiculous, should be seen in the context of heightened tensions. I think he directly mentioned the US investigation into FIFA.
He did rather tip his hand in exactly the same op-ed, yes.
Yeah, I think...
separate but unrelated development.
Yeah,
I'd like to...
Exactly. I mean, there's a wide view in Russia that that's a sort of conspiracy to prevent Russia from being able to host the World Cup and so on. And so I think perhaps it's a tit for tat on that, but it is hard to see them scoring any major political points with it.
It's a great shame that America probably isn't going to respond by announcing that it's going to launch an investigation into the Sputnik program. I mean, that would just be glorious. But Shashank, as Samira points out there, Mr. Markin has not been subtle in announcing himself here. This is clearly some sort of oblique revenge for America's investigations into FIFA and the chicanery which may or may not have occurred about the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. Is it possible to consider who he sees as the audience for this? Clearly, it's not likely to impress that many people overseas. Is this largely for domestic consumption?
Well, I wonder if you've ever looked at Russia Today comment threads and the sort of people who hang out on those.
I'm not actually worried about my blood pressure, but I suspect I would be quite quickly.
I think there's a large amount of people who will believe it's not really the content of the message, it's just some general sense of nefarious US behavior that they wish to have reinforced. But you know, I think it's a great idea and I'm in favor of this. And I think a team of six people should first spend 6 months investigating the moon landings. And when they're done, they should do a thorough and full probe into these similarly non-existent Russians in Ukraine and then present the findings to the UN General Assembly when it's all wrapped up.
But that is also the wider context this fits into, isn't it, Samira? And you did mention this, that this is not the first sort of... I mean, Russia Today and the Russian government haven't necessarily explicitly traded in conspiracy theory, but they have pursued a policy, both organisations, over the last few years in particular, of, I guess, promoting a somewhat permeable, malleable idea of reality. Do you think this is part of that, or is the thinking not necessarily that joined up?
No, I think it probably is part of that. As Shashank says, it's this sort of nefarious sense of the US or Western powers doing wrong, and that I think that sense goes from the ridiculous right up to the top, and that it's this sort of view of foreign policy as conspiracy, and that comes right down to these sort of small things, which I think are used by the Kremlin, by Russia Today, whatever it is, to illustrate the point that they're making, that, you know, these are not powers to be trusted.
Shashank, is there not a concern, and you know, Russia Today does promote a certain view of the world, doubtless dictated to it to a large extent from the Kremlin. The point where you get two sort of blocks, which is what happened in the Cold War, operating in completely different views of reality or completely different ideas of what reality actually is. There isn't an agreed narrative. How dangerous does that get?
I think it's profoundly dangerous. You know, they say truth is the first casualty of war. I think in the Russian case, it's taken hostage and shot in the head several times and dumped on the door of Russia Today. I think what it does is sow doubt in the minds of many people that any narrative is to be trusted at all, and therefore fundamental norms that have guided and kept Europe together for 60 years, like you don't invade countries, you don't annex countries, you don't change borders by force in Europe, are torn to shreds, and everyone thinks, well, it's he said, she said, and that's the end of it, so who knows?
Possibly worth acknowledging that a 2009 poll I found here in the UK found that one in four thought the moon landings were a hoax. 7% of Americans as of 2013. That is all we have time for today. Samira Shackle and Shashank Joshi, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Nikolacheva, Yolene Goffin and Mariana Zuniga. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, the aforementioned Fernando will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. Andrew Tuck follows with The Urbanist at 1900 hours. I'm back at 2200 hours with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, goodbye and thanks for listening.